Welcome to After Hours at the Radio Book Club. It's a podcast that's produced by KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU, Arsen Kashkashian, the head buyer at the Boulder Bookstore, as always my co-host. And today at the book club, we are speaking with Finn Murphy, a Boulder author whose first book is The Long Haul, A Trucker's Tales of Life on the Road. And as it is the After Hours podcast only edition, we can get into maybe some of the more adult themes aspects of life on the road, one of them being the truck stops, because this is something that is so part of pop culture. When I certainly, as a non-American, thought of American road trips, you think of these big truck stops, and then, you know, of course, you have all the truckers who pull in. It's not always a nice picture that you paint of the truck stops, and there's certainly some, you know, sleazy things happening at some of these. What's the real lowdown on truck stops here now in America?
The real lowdown is, well, they're better than they used to be, if that helps at all. There's a lot more women truck drivers now, although it's still only, it's a little under 7% are female, and a good number of those are husband and wife teams. So truck stops have been cleaned up a little bit. I've noticed that I have 5 sisters, so I've noticed this my whole life. But when women are around, men tend to behave slightly better than when they're not around. And when I first started driving in the 1980s, there were no women. And so the truck stops were very sketchy places. There was a lot of drugs around back then. There were a lot of prostitution. We call them sleeper leapers or, that's one of the names. Now with mandatory drug testing and with more women on the road, truck stops have generally been cleaned up. Another thing that cleans them up is there's so many baby boomers taking RVs all around the country, and they like to go to truck stops. So that's changed things around. And then on the other side of it is it used to be much more social, even though movers, they call us bedbuggers, even though the bedbuggers are sort of looked down upon at the truckers only coffee counter, a lot of the coffee counters in general are gone. And the trucks now are so much more comfortable, and, you know, people have satellite TV in there and stuff. A lot of guys just get into their jammies at the end of their driving day and get into the sleeper. So it's not nearly as social. And the CB radio social thing was another whole aspect of it. So all that's changing. But in general, I think any American, except for a few really notorious places, there's one outside of Chicago, there's one outside of in Ontario, California, where, you know, normal people don't want to go at all. But most of them, I think it's okay to go to.
You talk about the amount of drinking and driving that happened just as par for the course, certainly early on in your career, having beers at lunchtime, several beers, getting behind the wheel of a massive truck, and then more beers, and then more beers, and sometimes people drinking while they're actually driving.
All the movers back when I first started in the late 70s, the whole moving industry ran on an ocean of alcohol, and that's changed quite a bit. So I don't see too much of that. You certainly don't see somebody driving a big tractor trailer these days with a beer between his seat. But as a truck driver who can look down into everybody's cars,
yeah,
and, you know, people need to understand that a car is not an anonymous thing. It's got windows all around it. It's got a license plate. I mean, you're pretty easily identifiable. And I'm way up high, and I can look down and see what people are doing in their cars. And they're doing all kinds of things, and drinking is definitely one of them. Having an argument with the person in the passenger seat is another one. Eating is another one. Texting is another one. Putting on makeup is another one. Disciplining kids in the back seat is another one. And occasionally you might see a romantic moment or so, which is a nice treat, but very rare.
What's the weirdest thing you've seen from your position high up in a truck?
Well, some people just don't want to pull over and take a leak, you know? They'll just do it right there while they're driving. I saw a guy reading a book. He had the book right on his steering wheel, and I was alongside him for a while. He's turning the pages and looking up every once in a while.
Even as a bookseller, I find that kind of terrifying.
I know, we'll forgive a lot, right, Arsen?
But, yes. but perhaps don't read while you're driving. Reading in the passenger seat is just fine.
Well, there are books on tape options, and you do talk about being an avid consumer of books on tape, as well as being an avid consumer of public radio. As you say, are most truck drivers, whether or not they're politically aligned necessarily with the radio that they're listening to. But yeah, I mean, you have a lot of time on the road to think and to listen to a lot of content.
Yeah. So first thing is that every driver I know listens to public radio. And that has more to do with the fact that you can pick up a station when you're losing the station. So if I'm in New York City, I'm on WNYC, and I'm heading south on the Jersey Turnpike, I'll pick up WHYY in Philadelphia. Heading south from there, I'll pick up WAMU in Washington. And Richmond, Virginia, for some reason, is a dead spot. And then you pick up WUNC in North Carolina. So you can go all the way from Caribou, Maine, down to Key West, and you're going to get the continuity in the show. So that's what truckers really love. And then two things about political alignment is I'm not sure that National Public Radio, with the vast array of shows that they have any political alignment whatsoever. I mean, you'd have to be pretty sensitive to political alignments if you think wait, don't tell me is you know, obnoxious or car talk. I mean, haven't those guys been dead for like 10 years?
I like to think of the podcast as the book car talk. You know, if we could get to that level, just everybody's laughing.
People phone in with their book problems.
Yeah, wouldn't that be great?
That would be great.
And then, so I think there's a broad array of viewpoints that, it doesn't bother me. I mean, of course, I live in Boulder, but still, right. I'm probably the only truck driver who lives in Boulder. It's certainly the only truck driver that lives on Mapleton Avenue.
Right.
Well, although I'm getting priced out. I have to move myself on May 1st.
Oh no. We won't be
move or move thyself.
Move thyself.
But there are differences of opinions, because you do quote one driver as saying, calling it U.S. Jews and Girls Report. Was all things considered.
But he was a member of the Ku Klux Klan, as I remember.
I met him at a truck stop in Brunswick, Georgia. And we were sitting around the coffee counter talking about, you know, fresh air and all things considered. It was probably all things considered, which he called U.S. Jews and Girls Report, which is a horribly pejorative statement, but it is kind of witty in its own way.
Was he wearing his hood? I mean, how did he identify?
No, he wasn't wearing his hood, but he wanted to make sure that everybody knew. I think he was wearing a baseball hat that said,
"Make America Great." No.
Those are the new ones.
That's the new line.
His hat, I think his hat said, "American by birth, Southern by the grace of God."
Oh.
And I think his T-shirt said, "My two best friends are Charlie and Jack Daniels." But even so here's the other thing about if you're on the truck for 11 hours a day, you don't really care if you're hearing an opinion that's different than yours. As long as it has continuity, as long as the show's going on for an hour, you know, it passes the time. And then the second part of this is, it's a mistake to think that truck drivers are all a bunch of Southern rednecks. You know, there's 3.5 million of us. We come from everywhere. And since 2007, 2008, with the Depression and all that happened, there's been a whole slew of new people, new displaced middle-class people, into the trucking world. So it's not a homogeneous group of people at all.
But you talk about how Southern culture, though, for the freight haulers is certainly the overriding culture. Even if you're not Southern, you'd have the Leonard Skinner or whatever you're going to listen to, or the country music, and how you observe how people who are not even from totally different parts of the country seem to fall into that for a long time.
Yeah, so that's the cultural mass, so to speak. You know, the whole trucking thing is caught up in the, you know, American dream and in the go west young man, in the cowboy thing, and a lot of truckers espouse that myth. So you might find, I might be in a truck stop in Seattle, you know, I'll see some guy with a cowboy hat and a belt buckle and Tony Lama snakeskin boots, and he's from Manitoba, and he talks like the Dukes of Hazzard. I mean, I don't understand why that is, but the cultural mass is Southern and Western, cowboys and rednecks.
In terms of the demographics, I was really interested reading your book about all the rich people you move, because that's primarily who you're dealing with, very high end movers going to places like Aspen and some of the posh places in Florida. And the vast majority seem to be unrepentant assholes, which I can say because it's a podcast here, but not nice people at all, and certainly not nice to the hired help, as it were.
No, a lot of them aren't nice to the hired help. Part of this is people's relationship with the stuff that they have. many of the people I move, they have 3-4 houses. They'll have a house in, you know, a place in the West Village in New York City. They'll have a house in Nantucket. They'll have a house in Aspen, maybe one down in San Miguel de Allende, and maybe one in Gestad. And just the dynamics of just keeping, you know, your cashmere sweaters in the right place, or making sure that the heat's on in the house in Gestad. I mean, this is, you need to have a full-time manager who's taking care of all your things. Some people I move, they have 2 tractor trailers worth of stuff. I can put 40,000 pounds of stuff on one truck. So 2 trucks is 80,000 pounds of personal possessions, 40 tons of stuff. That's a lot of shopping, and it's a lot of stress. This is what I think a lot of my customers don't understand, that acquiring all of this stuff, it comes with a price, and the price is stress. And so if you're going to get mad at the movers because we're moving the stuff to somewhere else, that's okay. But they're also getting mad at the cleaning lady because she probably doesn't speak English. And they're probably getting mad at the contractor who hasn't fixed the copper gutters. And I mean, it's just a frustrating way to live. And this whole industry, so you got the moving industry, which is the people that work with me and load trucks and stuff, this is entirely non-English speaking. It's the landscaping industry in the United States is entirely non-English speaking. The house cleaning industry is non-English speaking. The restaurant industry at the back of the house is non-English speaking. All of these hardworking folks, which I hope I portray, I know I portray sympathetically in my book, they tend to catch the brunt of this in the service industries, and they catch more brunt if they don't speak the language. And one of the things I try to point out here is, you know, just because Juanita doesn't understand English doesn't mean that Juanita doesn't understand that she's getting disrespected. She certainly does, and so do I, and so does everybody in the service trenches. And people don't have to be that way.
Well, you talk about people being invisible, and you have this move where you're up in the mountains and there's nothing for about a half an hour away, and the homeowner runs out and gets lunch for himself but doesn't bring back anything for the crew. And that caused one of your crew members to get very upset and was tired of being invisible. And you bring in that you felt somewhat what it was like to be invisible, because, you know, as that the people who don't speak English are often invisible, and that you've felt that as a piece of this experience.
I do. And not only do people feel like they're invisible, they are treated as if they're invisible. They're not making a mistake here. They really aren't being looked at. You know, they don't look in their eyes. They don't just take a second to appreciate them as a fellow human being, because they're all stressed out about their move. And what, this is one of the things that mystifies me. You know, the poor guy from Croatia who's helping me move, you know, load this truck, he knows more about dislocation, confusion, and leaving his family and picking up sticks and going somewhere else, and all of that entails, than some, you know, American millionaire with his second house in Nantucket. He could actually receive some wisdom here if he would just take a minute to look at this person as a fellow human being. And so it's the customer, it's the shippers, which is what we call our customers. They're the ones that are missing out on some extra wisdom.
It seems to have really impacted your own life. Certainly the stuff, and I know you have said that you could just walk out of your house, which you're going to be doing soon. You're going to be moving your house. I'd be interested to see how many trucks or carloads it's going to take you to move your house. But I mean, how much stuff do you have now? I mean, really, it has impacted the stuff that you keep and the possessions, I suppose, that you have.
I have too many. I have too many books.
No, not possible. but you could bring them to the store and sell them as used books to us if you want.
I was just talking to them. I've seen you in the store the last 2 times I've been there, which both this week. So apparently you're on the floor a lot.
I work there, yeah.
Yeah, I know, but you're not shut up back in the office.
Just make eye contact and say his name. It makes Arson feel a lot better.
Oh, yeah, just another book buyer. Well, anyway, I forgot where I was going
You don't have that many possessions apart from the books.
No, I don't. And plus, moving for me is going to be very easy because I've got access to the trucks, the boxes, and the crew. So I'll be done. I mean, my house will be packed up by 10:30 in the morning. I mean, my move will be done by noon. I'll start at 8, depending on where I'm going. I don't know where I'm going yet.
So how do you live that? Because I think it's something a lot of people aspire to. I don't think a lot of people, especially people who might be paying for a storage unit, they don't even know what's in it, understand there is a cost to all of this stuff and understand that we have so many possessions that we don't even know what half of them are. I mean, how do you live that in terms of just, is this just a matter of just not acquiring stuff? I mean, how do you actually live this as part of your life?
Well, first thing is it's hard to not acquire things. And so it's because I walk into somebody's house and I'll spend an entire day packing up their kitchen. And I see the same things over and over and over again. I see, you know, scores of pieces of Tupperware that doesn't have a top. Right? Who's
you've
got been, that
you've
problem?
You've been in my kitchen.
The United States, everybody in the United States has that problem. I see sheets. Okay, so everybody uses maybe two sets of sheets. One's either getting cleaned or they use one set of sheets. But then the linen closet is filled with all these different kinds of sheets. It's very difficult to figure out which one's the twins and which one's the queens and which ones are the kings. So all of these sheets stay in there and they never get used except for the ones that are actually on the bed. There's that. There's all the toys and tools in the garage that just accumulate somehow. Because you go to the next door neighbor, you borrow a rake, and then he borrowed a rake, and buy a rake. And then movers come, and there's seven rakes in the garage. But it's so incremental. It's like the straw on the camel, right? You just acquire things day by day by day, and you don't know what happens until finally one day you say, oh, my God, I got to get this cleaned up. Instead of throwing it away, then they get the storage unit, and then it goes in there, and then it gets thrown away.
Ultimately, by your kids. I mean, at some point, this all stops, and somebody just says, I don't want any of this, and it all ends up in the landfill, I suppose.
It does.
Well, our complication is that it won't end up in the landfill because we decide to clear our stuff out, and then my wife, who wants to put everything where it should go. Like, we have to bring this to the hard-to-recycle place. We have to bring this to this, this to that. And I'm driving around right now with an old stereo in the back seat of the car because she said she was going to take it to the hard-to-recycle place like 3 months ago. Well, you know, Finn, I have to ask you something, though. In the book, we talked about NPR, but you mentioned Terry Gross by name. And Terry Gross, I'm from Philadelphia. She's one of my favorite people. I mean, she, you know, she broadcasts out of WHYY, you know, or we mentioned in Philadelphia. You got to be interviewed by her. Now, most authors who come on our show, I know this is the highlight of their author career. But for you, I mean, I know we can't really compare to Terry Gross, but tell us what it was like to actually, after listening to her for so many years, to suddenly have that voice talking to you.
And to say in the book that you've had a secret crush on Terry Gross as well.
I do have a secret crush. I still have a secret crush on Terry Gross.
Once you write it in a book.
It's actually more of a crush than it was before. And it was a pretty good crush before. Because, as I said in the book, I probably spent more time with Terry Gross than anyone else in my life because I would never miss fresh air when I was driving. Because it was... Well, when it first started, it was an hour and a half. And, I mean, I go back so far, it was when she was just on WHYY, which is like 47 years ago or something like that. And now, you know, now she's national. But I would always listen to Fresh Air. And, I mean, there's another idea, thing about NPR. I mean, Fresh Air is not particularly, it doesn't have any kind of political angle at all. And you're always getting some good cultural, you know, information from that show. But yes, to talk to Terry was actually really frightening. Then I came into the studio because she does it from home. I didn't know this, so nobody sees Terry. I was actually talking to a guy at WHY. He'd been there for like 10 years. He said he's never seen Terry.
That's a bit Wizard of Oz esque.
Yes, it is a little Wizard of Oz esque. So I was really nervous, and then she got on, and we talked for about 5 or 10 minutes before the show. And funny, her voice is different when she's talking to you normally than, you know, this is Fresh Air, I'm Terry Gross.
Maeve's got to work on that.
I got a Texas twang when I'm not on the radio. So
do you really?
I know all about your radio voice here. This is persona I've cultivated for my career. Anyway.
So she's got the radio voice. And that's, you know, that, she's got a great voice. And it's kind of sexy. And it's kind of, you know, she's omniscient in tone. So you're thinking, wow, who's this sexy person that knows everyone and everything? I can't believe I'm talking to her. But she wasn't like that at all. She's just amazing, charming, and maybe relaxed. And then pulled a lot of information out on the interview that I didn't really want to be giving. I don't know how that happened.
She does that.
Yeah, she does that.
You get very comfortable. Have you heard from any truckers who heard you on Fresh Air while they were trucking?
I haven't, but I've heard from lots of truckers who have seen my book or seen some other stuff that's interviews or whatever that have happened here and there.
And are they gunning for you now, Finn Murphy? Or
no!
Like, yes,
and
represent.
I thought they would be. Because I do a little diss about freight haulers in the book. Not too serious, and I'm not serious about that. But I was in Gary, Indiana at 5 o'clock in the morning at a truck stop getting a coffee, and somebody sort of tapped me on the shoulder. And I turned around and looked, and all I could see was this green T-shirt. And I looked up. This guy's about 6'7". And he said, "U-turn," which is my CB handle, and which I talk about in the book. And I looked at him, and he said, "You tell it like it is." And I said, "Thank God. Let me buy you a cup of coffee." So that's actually the only time I've been singled out as a famous person at the Gary truck stop at 5 a.m. Otherwise, I can still go out to dinner and everything. Yeah.
Well, in terms of the CB handle, I mean, I grew up in the era of Convoy and that movie, and that made a huge impression on me back in the day, how many years ago that was. And everyone had their CB handle, and then, of course, there was that wonderful song. But it seemed like there was a real brotherhood in the truck driving community. That doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, it's still out there. You're talking, was that the movie with Ally McGraw with Chris Christopherson? Yes, I just saw that movie again. Ally McGraw, that woman cannot act. It's unbelievable.
I was in love with her, though.
Because her love story, right?
Probably. I don't know. I just knew I grew up loving Ally McGraw. And then, like you, if I ever see her now, I'm like, boy, she can't act.
But there was BJ and the Bear. There was Smokey and the Bandit. There was a whole popular culture thing that was going on in the mid to late 70s. And that died the death perhaps it deserved. I'm not sure. But we do all have CB handles. And there's a couple rules about CB handles, by the way. You have to give it to yourself. It should be two syllables. And it should evoke something about either the work that you do or the characterization you would like the world to see. So mine is U-turn. So, and that's because in my work, I'm always turning the truck around. And U-turns can be very difficult to do. So it shows a little bit about my pride and my driving skills. It shows what I do every day. And it's two syllables and it's given to me. So you guys need to have your own handles.
This reminds me of, there's this game you play for your porn star name. It's the first name is your first pet and your second name is the street that you grew up on. This is a whole other beast, but it kind of reminds me of it, yeah.
I would be Pigeon Briarwood. Briarwood, oh, perfect.
I would be Lucky Larkfield.
That's excellent.
Wonderful alliteration, which is often lacking in porn star names. But we digress here.
Well, wait a minute. I want to give you mine.
All right, go ahead.
So I could be, this is a great porn star name, Major Mead.
We could write a book on this. This could be your next book, except you already have your next book underway. And believe it or not, you have a whole other slew of tales to tell about another career that you've had, which was also involved with driving, but it was in a different country.
Yep, it was in a different country. So when I left North American Van Lines, I had a bunch of money in my pocket, and I bought a textile import company in Stamford, Connecticut, that imported woolen clothing and textiles from Ireland. And it was a very bad purchase. the person who sold it to me did very well out of it. I've been a truck driver for 10 years, and then all of a sudden I'm in this new business in an industry I didn't know anything about. And so I had to travel over to Ireland all the time and source these goods, which was great, which was the best part of the business, but I didn't make any money at it. And I used to go to woolen mills and hand knitters in the northwest of Ireland, and I'd drop off the raw wool to all these places up in the northwest, and they would knit the sweaters, and I'd come back a couple weeks later, and I'd go around and pick them all up, and I'd pick up, 500 or 600 of them from all these farmhouses, and then consolidate them at Shannon Airport, and then bring them to the U.S. and pay the duty and sell them off to other stores. So that was actually a lot of fun.
So in terms of a changing industry and, you know, the parallels with trucking, automation, various different things. I mean, do you still have those little old women knitting in farmhouses and you, somebody like you picking up the sweater and it ultimately end up in the store over here?
I don't think so. And, you know, there's two ways of looking at that whole industry, too, because some people thought it was very exploitive. And that's, in one sense, you know, I was paying them, you know, £25 for, you know, a hand-knit sweater. Probably took them 30 hours to knit. On the other hand, you know, a lot of these are big families out in the Gaeltacht and, you know, might have 6 or 7 children. And mom's got to be at home. And grandma's at home, and this is a way to, you know, to get some pin money. So that there's two ways of that. And then there were some very sophisticated woolen mills in Ireland at the time. There was Donegal Design, Cushendale Woolen Mills used to make beautiful mohair things. It was very well developed in terms of wool, not sort of noble fibers and things like that. So that was a really good time, but that started to, when the Celtic Tiger started coming in the 80s, those woolen mills and home industries really disappeared very, very quickly. And a couple other reasons for that. I don't know if you noticed this, in the United States, there's the Textile Labeling Act of 1938, which means every piece of clothing in the United States that is sold, on the left-hand seam, it has washing instructions, country of origin, and fabric content. Anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not true in the EU. So what happened in the 90s was people were starting to import Aran sweaters from Greece, from Nicaragua, from China. And since there was no labeling requirement, you couldn't tell if it was made by Bridget O'Shaughnessy in Kilcar or by Yong Lu in Shanghai. So
Maeve could tell. You could figure it out, couldn't you, Maeve?
Probably not. But interestingly enough, I remember meeting a sheep farmer from New Zealand once, many, many years ago when I was in California. And they talked about the death of the woolen industry. It was quite similar in New Zealand. I think they have as many sheep as we do in Ireland. With the introduction of fleece and the artificial fabrics, and they said nobody wants wool anymore. Nobody wants those natural fabrics. And that got me thinking. I was like, it's probably the exact same thing in Ireland, which had a vibrant industry due to, you know, the natural textiles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that hurt the industry a lot. And, you know, calling it fleece, you know, this is a petrochemical made out of plastics. And how does Patagonia get to be one of the green companies on Earth when everything it makes is a petrochemical? And the poor woolen manufacturer in Greg Nomana Kilkenny, who's actually making, you know, natural fibers. But fortunately, Smart Wool is a great company. That's brought natural fibers back. But the fleece hit it hard. And it hit it so hard between the falling down of natural fibers and the Irish economy turning into something else that was starting to disappear. So I went over to, I started going to Scotland and then started working with cashmere, which is, there's no, Ireland has some raw material, but the woolen stuff in Ireland was always, wasn't super industrialized. Whereas in Scotland, it was much more industrialized because of the Industrial Revolution in the 1840s, where the power loom was invented. So the Scottish were always better in value-added products, and they always better in investment, because the British money from London was investing in Scotland, and they weren't obviously investing for Ireland, for which we could talk about forever. But
that's another podcast.
That's another podcast. It's still going on. So I started going to Scotland and getting into higher value stuff, and that's how come I got into the cashmere business. And then I watched the cashmere business fall apart in Scotland in the same way that the woolen business fell apart in Ireland, for very similar reasons, and from foreign competition from China mostly.
Cashmere, though, that's a specific type of wool. I mean, it's not just how it's processed.
It comes from a cashmere goat, which only come from Mongolia. So the raw material, people think of Scotland and Ireland, Scotland and Italy when they think of cashmere, but the raw material doesn't come from there. It never has. It always came from Mongolia, and it was always brought to Scotland because some Scottish inventor, you know, these Scottish inventors, Alexander Graham Bell, Andrew Carnegie, Robert Fulton, all of, you know, almost everything in the modern world was invented by Scotsmen. And he invented this dehairing machine, which separated the guard hairs from the soft hairs on a goat. And they wouldn't send the dehairing machine anywhere, so all the raw material had to go to Scotland. So Scotland controlled the cashmere business for 100 years.
Mm. Interesting.
The things you learn here.
The
on
things
the podcast.
You learn. Yeah. One last question, and then we'll move away from wool.
Oh,
promise.
Okay. I could talk about wool all day long.
Well, yeah. Llamas, because llamas got really popular as a business investment here in Colorado, and there was stories about people investing all their life savings and buying a herd of llamas because apparently llama wool was the next big thing, and then they lost all their money. What do you know about that?
Alpaca.
Well, that's what it is. An alpaca, a llama.
Alpaca is the fleece from a llama. Okay. Yeah. Or there's alpaca. An alpaca is also an animal. And then you have mohair goats, which is another one. You have the cashmere goats. You have the Tibetan antelope called the charru, which makes chatouche. All of these are called noble fibers. Now, I could really get boring about this, so I won't do that. I'll just say that depending on the diameter of the particular hair, the lower the diameter, the softer it is. So alpaca was a big thing for a while. The trouble with alpaca is it's itchy. It's got doesn't have long fibers, so it gets a little bit itchy. But it feels great. It got that little wet feel, a sort of heavy thing to it.
But when that book comes out, when does that book come out?
Oh, I have to write it.
He hasn't written it yet. Okay.
Yeah, well, we've taken all the thunder from it. I mean, I don't know.
We'll just
replay this as the book club.
There
for
you
that
go.
Book
well, I was going to say we could do some live on-air knitting.
So it's the longer fibers, though, they're itchy.
The shorter ones.
The shorter ones are itchy. Because I gave my wife, not to talk about my wife again, but she's not in town right now, so I can talk about her.
She will be when this goes to air.
Yeah, by the time this airs. But
you better
I bought her like these three beautiful sweaters for Christmas maybe 5 years ago, and she wore two of them quite often. And just the other day, she said she had to get rid of the third one because it has always itched her, and she didn't want to tell me. But that wasn't really my fault. That was the animal's fault,
right?
It's
not your fault.
For not growing sufficiently long enough hairy wool.
Well, that's why you want to check the country of origin fabric content of whatever you buy. So
I'm going to go home and check all my labels now.
You need, it's not going to go into that much detail, but for cashmere, for example, you need long, staple Mongolian cashmere, white Mongolian cashmere. So it's hard to find.
I'm partial to cashmere. I only buy it in thrift stores because it's very expensive, but you'd be surprised at how much cashmere is floating around. But now I need to pay attention to maybe country of origin.
Scotland and Italy.
Italian cashmere.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah, it does. Doesn't
so it gets, here's the thing, we can, you know, whatever. it gets, so the cashmere clip gets auctioned every April. So what happens, all the Mongolian herders come down into Ulaanbaatar with the raw material. And it's got, you know, sticks and dung and dirt on it and all these kind of things. And then it gets sent to Beijing to process, or it gets sent over to Scotland. So it looks just like a tobacco auction you would have seen in Virginia years ago. So these giant warehouses, and then all these buyers come in from all over the world, and then they have these little probe things, and they stick it into the bale, and they'll bring it out, and then they put it under the microscope because, you know, the Chinese will tell you it's long staple white Mongolian cashmere, and it's, you know, gray short staple yak wool. So you have to check it all. But so the best cashmere gets bought up early by the Scots and the Italians. Mm-hmm. And then the other stuff is left for the domestic production of Chinese. So if you go buy a cashmere sweater from say Costco, it might not even be cashmere, and B, it's not going to be long staple Mongolian white. It sounds like piece of cocaine, doesn't it?
I feel like I've got a window into a whole other world here.
Wow.
Who knew all of this?
So that's my other book. That's going to be my book.
That'll be your book. Well, in terms of the driving experience, because your book, The Long Haul, is all about being a trucker, how does that compare with driving around the highways and byways of northwestern Ireland, Donegal, which I've done myself, so I know what those roads are like.
Yeah.
I often say that the speed limit is more of a speed challenge because you'd be hard-pressed to go as fast as they tell you can on some of these roads.
The roads are small, aren't they? They're winding. I mean, how do they lay those roads out? I think they chased a
wild
boar.
It's to confuse the tourists.
Yeah, is it?
They look good on, like, car commercials when you see this road snaking through this.
Yeah, just try driving it.
Yeah.
Oh, and they got the fuchsia hedge right up against the side of the road, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. You can't go anywhere. I used to love driving up in there. And of course, it's on the wrong side of the road.
Well, the right side for us.
Sorry.
The left side.
Well, the one last question I had is, you know, to go back to sex is how we started the... How we started this whole thing.
Lot lizards.
I know. I love the word you used in the book. That was one of the most fun things. But you had this one shipper that you, a wife of a shipper that you ended up hooking up with. And you had like three wonderful nights, it seemed like, with her. And then she just went back to her life. Did you ever wonder about her? I mean, she was kind of in a miserable place in her marriage, obviously, because she's sleeping with the mover. But
something tells me I should take umbrage there, but I'm not quite sure where to take that umbrage. So I think you're right. Yeah,
but it was kind of a romantic passage. I mean, you know, it was very sweet, actually. It wasn't like this tawdry one night stand or something.
And it was a tawdry three night stand, yeah, as far as I remember.
It wasn't really tawdry, I didn't think. But you know, you never tracked her back down, or hopefully her husband's never tracked you down. I just wonder what your thoughts on that are now, a few years later or several years later. You know. About that kind of incident in your career.
Yeah, so I really, that's the chapter's called Waiting Time. I really like that chapter. And I didn't really know what I was writing until it was over and what was really happening there. So the first thing is she seduced me, not the other way around. I wasn't actually looking for this. And then... As you say, it was three nights, and then she decided that she was going to go back to where she was from with her husband. And I think what this chapter is about is how a woman can feel trapped and not have any options that she can see in her life in this particular demographic. So she was a military wife. She had a child. Her mother was a military wife. She had come from a military family. This is all that she knew. And it turns out she was married to this monster. And he was moving her without a spoiler alert, but he was exiling her out to the middle of the country to get her and his son out of the way. And she was trapped in a way that she couldn't see any way out of. And so she took me on as a sort of fuck you to her husband, and then went back to her husband, and as she had explained to me, this is at least something that she can look back on for her life, where she took control over her destiny, at least for a short period of time, and ran things and did what she wanted instead of what was expected of her. So I think it's a poignant, interesting chapter.
I thought you wrote about it beautifully.
Thank you.
I mean, it was somebody who needed some human comfort. You know, this woman, as you describe her, you know, really lived a life without passion, without love. I mean, she had love with her son, but she needed something, and she claimed it. And so it is very affirming from the woman's standpoint, I thought.
That's exactly how I look at it. It's affirming from the woman's standpoint. But from my standpoint, you know, I'm not complaining about it at all, but, you know, in totality, you know, I was used. I don't feel violated about it, but, you know, I was used for someone else's purposes, and that never feels good.
Well, in terms of the dynamics then of families that you encounter at a specific time, because when you're moving, it's a major life disruption, and it's very often due to a divorce, death, you know, it's some type of displacement. So I'm sure you just become a keen observer of dynamics between spouses, between families. And then even if the family is staying together with the move, it often seems that there's one person is causing the move. It's one person's job that is causing the family to uproot and move across. I mean, you really must have seen quite a few dynamics. I mean, is there a commonality that you've seen when you're meeting families at this time?
Yes, there always seems to be some level of conflict. And a lot of it has to do with a husband and wife, or a husband who's no longer with a wife, or a death. All of those things, I see those all the time. And what, if you want a commonality, is rather than think about a person's place in the community or what a person's family life is going to look like now, or what your friends you're going to have, or the friends that you're losing, or any of those things, people tend to zero back in on their stuff. And it becomes about the crock pot instead of, my sister who lives four doors down. And I think it's a way not to think about those kinds of things. So what happens is, you put a crack in the mover puts the crack in the crock pot. And then all of a sudden there's a nuclear conflagration about the crock pot. And it's not about the crock pot. And I know that because I've seen this 3,200 times, but she's only moved twice. So she doesn't understand that when she's screaming at me about her crock pot, that it's not about that. So I'm cool with that. I can take that all day long, no problem. And I'm not going to say, ma'am, this is not about the crock pot. I'm not a psychotherapist. But that's really what it is.
I guess you could be a psychotherapist if you're looking for yet another career.
Well, some people call me a cultural anthropologist, and some people call me an opinionated wise guy. So I hope to be somewhere in between those two things.
Well, now you're a published author. Add that to your list. Yes.
And what a Cinderella story, huh? So Fresh Air, Terry Gross, right? KGNU.
Oh, KGNU was first.
KGNU was first. And then I was reviewed in the New York Times twice. 2 days ago, I was reviewed in the Times Literary Supplement.
Wow.
Paris Review. So
really?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
LA Times, Denver Post, Boston Globe. I mean, I can't believe it. It's just, it's been wonderful.
And well, it's a singular book.
It is. And why do you think it has captured so many people's imagination? Because we got a huge response from our listeners when we aired that original interview with you a year ago.
Because everybody's driven down the highway. They've all looked up at the truck. And they've always wondered what that kind of life would be like. And if you're on your morning commute and you're sipping your coffee and you're stuck in traffic and you look up at the truck and it's got a Maine license plate on it, and you see then there's a person up there and you see the arms and it looks kind of comfortable and he might have a clean shirt on a hanger behind him and you can see that there's a sleeper there and it's a nice new good-looking truck and you're in Denver and that truck's from Maine and you're having a lousy commute and you had an argument with your wife in the morning and you look up at that truck and you say, man, that looks like something interesting.
Or it could be a snowy morning like it was today and I would be not switching places for somebody in one of those big trucks.
You know
what? All the money in the world.
I was in Erie, Colorado this morning where we keep some of our trucks, and I had to start three trucks this morning at 6 o'clock because big trucks don't like 0 degree weather. You have to keep them going. So that's where I was till about 11.
Well, I'm glad you're here now.
I'm really glad I'm here now.
Well, Finn Murphy is the author of The Long Haul, a trucker's tales of life on the road. Thank you so much.
Thank you.